Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Nina Teicholz as my special expert guest. Nina Teicholz is an investigative journalist and author of the International and New York Times bestseller, The Big Fat Surprise. Nina attended Yale and Stanford, where she studied biology and majored in American studies. She has a master's degree from Oxford University and served as associate director of the Center for Globalization and Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Before taking a deep dive into researching nutrition science for nearly a decade, Nina was a reporter for National Public Radio and also contributed to many publications, including The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, The New Yorker, and The Economist. Her best-selling book, The Big Fat Surprise, was named a 2014 best book by The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Mother Jones, and Library Journal. Good morning, Nina, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Thank you. Good morning to you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
Wonderful. I'm just so buzzed out because I just finished reading your book. I'm going to read it again. Absolutely phenomenal. You know, the degree of courage and the amount of effort that it took. Because I'm a publisher, you know, I have courses and I'm a writer too. So I have a bit of an idea of the amount of work that it took. And we're going to get into this. So hats off for this massive achievement, Nina.
Well, thank you very much. It did take nearly a decade to write this book, which was seemed like a crazy undertaking all throughout that time. But I'm glad it's out there now.
Now, did you wake up at, say, 8 years of age and tell your mom and dad, hey, I'm going to be an investigative journalist? How did that happen? What led you to this career path?
I have to say, and this is for your students who don't know what they want to do with their lives, I really did not know what I wanted to do with my life. I loved science, which is what I ended up writing about. But I also loved art history. I love writing. My father is an engineer. My mom was an art historian. So I was always like schizophrenic and never knew what to do. The reason I became a journalist in the end was that after college, still not knowing what I wanted to do, having done all my pre-med courses, but deciding I didn't want to become a doctor. And I sort of landed in Washington, D.C., and all my most interesting friends were journalists. Like, they were people like me who just wanted to talk and think about everything under the sun. And so that's how I became a journalist.
What's the advantage of writing as a journalist as opposed to, say, a medical expert on this kind of topic?
Good question. I think there's a general answer, which is that you can write in a language that is exciting and interesting, colorful, poetic, which is something you cannot do in scientific journals. And I think there's also an answer to that question really specific to nutrition science, which is the field that I got involved in, which is that nutrition science is so captive to a certain way of thinking that the people who are pushing the boundaries, I have to say myself included, really come from outside the field. And I would argue had to come from outside the field because, you know, otherwise, if we were inside the field, we would have lost our research funding. We would have never succeeded. We would never be invited to expert conferences. So in this particular field, I think being an outsider has been essential in order to say things that people inside the field cannot say.
I think your background in biology and science as a general is extremely relative and important. So give a synopsis of what you think science is. What does it mean to you? What does that word mean to you?
Well, I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. I think that science done properly is an incredibly important endeavor of the human mind to try to make sense out of the observations that we see, how to understand the world. But it's so complicated in nutrition science because nutrition is such a hard science to do, right? Very hard to get people to change their diet, stick to another diet. So nutrition science has been a complicated field that has been, I would say, really dominated by bad science because of the difficulties in doing the science well. And it's a field where science has to be, I would say, humbled by the contribution that that history can make. So, you know, scientists tend to get very committed to the idea of randomized controlled clinical trials. That's the gold standard. In nutrition, we also have the whole human record going back to really Paleolithic times about what humans ate when we were healthy before the epidemics of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. And that historical anthropological record really must be brought to bear on making conclusions about a healthy diet as well. So it's a much more holistic picture about how various different academics can come to bear on the question of what is a healthy diet.
Yes, you made that point in the book, and I thought it was a very important point. You've got to look back in time, look at the records, what does the evidence show? I think that what you also stated was that a lot of the current thoughts about nutrition are not taking that into account. So that's very important. Now, of all of the areas of nutrition, because we can cover a lot just through our own personal interests. For me, I was young. I wanted to be well. There was some death in my family. It shocked me, and I didn't want to be that way. So my interest in nutrition was because it was initiated by a pure, genuine interest as a young person. And how do I get well? That was the question I asked. How do I get well? Brought me into fitness and nutrition. But why this particular area of nutrition as opposed to all of the other areas that you could have gotten into?
It just happened to me. I did not actively choose it. I had been assigned a story on trans fats by my editor at Gourmet Magazine. I was doing a series of investigative food stories for that magazine. And she said, have you heard of trans fats? And I said, nope. And so she said, well, I want you to do a story on them. This is the early 2000s. And I investigated the world of trans fats. I found, lo and behold, there were stories like the woman who had been a pioneer in understanding trans fats. Okay, so trans fats result, they turn out that they're a harmful kind of fat that result when you harden vegetable oils through a process called hydrogenation. And that process started in the early 1900s and resulted in the first ever hardened oil commercial product known as Crisco. So it was always an artificial process. The woman who had been the pioneer in this field, it turned out she had suffered all kinds of harassment, basically, by her colleagues, people from the margarine industry visiting her office to try to shut her down, people calling journals trying to get her papers withdrawn before they were published, people harassing her at scientific meetings, standing up and yelling at her. I thought, is this science? What is going on here? It was really not what I imagined science should look like. And it opened up for me this huge world about fats in general. Fats, of course, what Americans obsess about most because we've been told to: low fat, high fat, non-fat, good fat, bad fat. It's a source of, you know, a major target for all of our dietary recommendations. And the more I looked into this field, the more I realized we seem to have gotten it completely upside down and backwards and wrong on what was good and bad about dietary fats. So that experience researching that article, which led to a book contract, really became this larger endeavor and a book I wanted to write in the end, which was about really about all fats. Although my book ends up focusing on saturated fats, the sad kind of fats found in meat and dairy and coconut and palm oil. That's where I ended up in the end. But that's how it all started. It was just an accident.
Sometimes accidents lead to prosperity and change that is remarkable. Now, the diet heart hypothesis, you know, that term is used quite frequently in your text. It's really the guts, the nuts and bolts, more or less, because you're kind of looking at this objectively as a scientist and saying, hold it now, a lot of what's being promoted is not necessarily factual or true. So before we get into that, what you discovered, what is the low-fat diet heart hypothesis in a nutshell?
The diet heart hypothesis holds that saturated fats, the kind found in meat, dairy, coconut, palm oil, those fats plus cholesterol, dietary cholesterol, so eggs, liver, shellfish, saturated fat and dietary cholesterol will raise your blood cholesterol, clog your arteries, and give you a heart attack. That is the essence of the diet heart hypothesis. It was proposed by Ansel Benjamin Keys, a physiologist from the University of Minnesota in the 1950s, and it was solidified as policy starting in 1961 when the American Heart Association issued the first ever recommendations worldwide on how to avoid heart disease. How to do that? Avoid saturated fat and cholesterol.
Okay, so Ansel Keys, who also was behind the development of the K rations, is that correct?
That's correct.
And of course, if you have a look at the K rations, you know just how wonderful they are. What a beautiful assortment of fresh, organic, whole, real food.
You know, the reason that that is an interesting story is just that he was a very persuasive, convincing man. Here's a man who was able to get his idea of a good diet into the entire military, right? That's a demonstration of his ability to persuade people in power. And it was he, Ansel Keys, who persuaded the American Heart Association to adopt his hypothesis about how to avoid heart disease. That's a really fundamental part of the story because, you know, people wonder, you know, there are various theories of history. Is it guns, germs, and steel like Dara Diamond writes about in his book? I mean, yes, that's part of the explanation for the course of history. The course of history in nutrition science can be much better explained by the great man hypothesis, which is powerful, persuasive, charismatic people moving history. And Ansel Keys was one of those people.
How do you explain the anomaly that he lived to 100 years of age?
Well, he is documented as not having followed his own diet. He was found eating, you know, multiple rashers of bacon for breakfast at conferences. He describes himself as eating red meat only three nights a week. That would be considered, I think, like quite a lot of meat by today's standards. But he did not really cut back on meat, at least that I can tell from the documentation I found in his lifetime.
Right. And it most likely just is an anomaly because if you study geriatrics and this whole phenomenon of living that long, there's other variables that we have to look at and consider. Now, let's talk about the seven country study because that was pivotal in your presentation on him using that in the wrong way. Is that right?
Well, the seven country study was a groundbreaking study that was led by Ansel Keys. It took place in the 1950s. And the reason that I went into it in great depth in my book is that if you read, or if you are unfortunate enough to read 10,000 papers on nutrition science, as I have done, you will find that a great majority of them go back and cite this seven country study. It's like the big bang of nutrition science because it was a pioneering study, the largest ever of its kind when the field was just sort of being born. So it was very, very influential in terms of setting us on the course that we are today about what we think is a healthy diet. So that's why I examined that study in so much detail. And just to give you a broad overview, it was on nearly 13,000 men, only men in seven countries, mostly in Europe, but also the US and Japan. And it found what Ansel Keys had set out to find because he already had the hypothesis baked in his mind before he started the study. And that was the less saturated fat that the men ate, the less likely they were to die from heart disease. So, you know, I go through that study with a fine-tooth comb, go to the foreign language journals where he seemed to bury data. I mean, it's really an amazing story where he really tried to present his data in a way, he kind of forced his data to support his hypothesis. But the basic thing to say about that study is it's an epidemiological study, and that means it can only show association. It can never establish causation. That's one of the first rules in science. So he found an association, not causation. And then if you go into the study and look at it in detail, did he even find an association? Well, not really. I mean, there's all kinds of problems with the study. Like, just as in a small example, people in Corfu ate far less saturated fat than the Greeks on Crete, but the people on Corfu died at much higher rates of heart disease. So there were just so many problems with his study. It's like you can't even begin to elucidate on them all, but it was an important study. And when the criticisms of that study started to come to light in the 1980s, it had already sort of set nutrition science on course to the path that it is remains today. And so the critiques have sort of came too far, too late and too little. With that said, I will say that, you know, in the last maybe 10 years, there's been a kind of renewed effort at the critiques of that study, evaluating his work, and that has started to percolate through the scientific community and the lay community. And so I think there has been a real evaluation of his contribution.
Yes, it just brings to mind also that if you have a large enough population that is really ignorant in terms of the question I asked you, what is science? I really think they don't know what it is. Everyone knows the word, we've heard the word, but we don't really think in scientific terms as a collective. So obviously you get someone that is animated and charismatic, which, as you know, in science should be irrelevant. It should be completely irrelevant. We look at facts and logic and math and statistics and biology and physics and chemistry. We bring it all together and see whether or not there is a causality point established. So that plays a big role in this too. In order to persuade a whole nation, because you mentioned that the British were not persuaded, maybe you could talk about that, how they kind of looked at Americans as this whole thing being a big joke, this low-fat notion, because we go to England quite frequently. I was in Scotland last year, and everyone starts off their breakfast with bacon and eggs and sausage. Well, you probably know what it's like.
The British opposition to this hypothesis promoted by Ansel Keys was they simply could not fathom, really, articles published in The Lancet and other top medical journals, they could not fathom the American obsession with cholesterol. They simply just didn't understand. It. They thought it was a kind of fixation. They resisted adopting this idea of the diet heart hypothesis for decades, and they only succumbed fairly late in the game. It speaks to an interesting issue, which is that, you know, why was America so particularly susceptible to these ideas? And most other countries were not for decades, and not until this whole idea started in America and eventually was exported to other countries around the world. But for decades, they resisted it. And I think that's because in America, we are a nation of immigrants. We leave behind our grandparents, our grandmother's cookbooks. We are searching to assimilate. We're looking for the new. We all want to be bound together in an American society. We're particularly believers in science. And so American housewives were persuaded of this theory, and they did not have their grandmothers nearby saying, well, you know, we don't cook that way. We don't use Crisco. We use butter, and that's the way it's done. Whereas in other countries, they've adhered and stayed closer to their own cultural heritage. In, you know, food is one aspect of a cultural heritage. So I think that was a difference that was seen not only in the UK, but in other countries as well. You know, there is this question sort of why, as you say, these nutrition scientists and Ansel Keys and his colleagues did not act like scientists, in that they did not doubt their own beliefs. They only looked for evidence to support their own beliefs. And, you know, one of the fundamental tenets of science, if you're a scientist, I'm not, but, you know, I tried to train my brain to act like one, which is to doubt yourself, to doubt your beliefs, to rigorously test them and try to disprove them. That is certainly what I did when I was writing my book. I would nightly lay down on the ground and say to my husband, I cannot do this. I must be wrong. I must, it cannot be that I'm right and that this, you know, all these esteemed scientists are wrong. So I would rigorously try to disprove all my beliefs. But that is not what's happened in nutrition science, as I document really quite extensively in the book, is the effort to shore up one's own beliefs, one's own hypothesis. Ansel Keys did this repeatedly. He thought he was right until proven wrong, which is really the opposite of what scientists are taught. And not only that, but he and his colleagues would bully scientists who believed to the contrary. So that's when I tell people, I know I'm not trained as a scientist, but I've been trained I studied politics in college, and it's really more about the politics of science than it is about the actual evidence and data of science in this particular story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most people think naturally that somehow science is immune from politics. Of course, it's made up of people, and that's politics 101. So I learned from Aristotle that a scientist is a human that thinks like a scientist. That's all. And then I was curious about all these people that claim to be scientists. You know, going through that process myself, I realized that no person, no university in the world offers a degree as a scientist. You can't get a degree as a scientist. You can get a degree in biology and chemistry and physics. So it's implied through your education. But there are still individuals who might understand the scientific principle and yet completely violate them in their own personal life. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, I think I write about them extensively in my book, which is all these scientists. I mean, that's the case. I mean, people who are not scientists, that we all understand, of course, you're going to select views that support your own beliefs, you know, and then kind of disregard views to the contrary. And that's what is supposed to not happen in science. So it was continually stunning to me to see how these scientists not only ignored vast amounts of data that contradicted them, but actively suppressed it. And I don't use the word suppress lightly because I know it makes me sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I'm saying buried results in basements, did not publish them, excluded them from any kind of review papers. I mean, there's such malfeasance that went on in this field. It really does rise to the level of the word suppression.
Yeah. In biochemistry, one of the first great lessons I learned was that carbohydrates, as in glucose or sugars, are not essential in human biochemistry. Fatty acids, amino acids, vitamins, minerals are, but not carbs. Well, that was the first clue that kind of freed me from this chain that most people have around their neck when it comes to thinking, I have to have carbs, I'm going to die without carbs, carbs are essential. Now, then I eventually came across the letter on corpulence. I was very pleased to see you mention William Banting. Tell us about him and what you discovered through that letter.
William Banting was an Englishman who lived in the latter half of the 19th century, and he suffered from morbid obesity, and such that he was starting to lose his hearing. And he went to a doctor who believed that if he could lose weight, that somehow that he was going deaf because of the pressure of all of his fat cells on his eustachian tubes. So the suggestion was to try to lose weight. And he said, well, I can't do this. All of my doctors have been trying to help me lose weight. I've starved myself. I've exercised for 4 hours a day, and none of that has helped me. I don't know if that sounds familiar to anybody out there listening who might have also tried those treatments for obesity, but he had he was unusually lucky to have a doctor who had discovered the writings of some French theorists who, in looking at how animals gained weight, discovered that carbohydrates, which is, you know, grains, breads, crackers, and even starchy vegetables, that they led to a unique fattening in animals. And so it applied that theory to William Banting, a human. Could it be true that the restriction of carbohydrates would reverse his fattening? And so he is one of the first cases that we know, or maybe the first case we know, of a human going on a very low carbohydrate diet. Very low carbohydrates and high in fat. And for him, it worked. It was tremendous. I can't remember how much weight he lost, but I'm sure it was well over 100 pounds. And he wrote a little booklet on that, the letter on corpulence. And he was like the Robert Atkins of his day. He sold thousands and thousands of copies. And to go on a low carbohydrate diet, as he recommended, was known to bant or to go banting. It's actually a term that's now been adopted in South Africa. So if you In South Africa, if you go on a low-carb diet, you're banting. They're banting menus at South African restaurants. So, you know, he was a pioneer. And then that knowledge sort of disappeared over time. But he was one of the first cases we know of a low-carbohydrate diet.
Did you come across Weston Price at all and his great paper, Nutrition Against Disease, in your research?
Yes. I mean, he was very formative for me. He was a dentist who traveled the world in, I think, the late 1800s, early 1900s. He observed isolated human populations all over the world in what he called the process of nutrition transition. So going from their traditional diets to ones where they started to import foods from abroad. And those were mainly carbohydrate-based foods because that's what travels well, like jam and crackers and refined carbohydrates. And he was a dentist, so he was interested in examining their teeth. And what he found is that these imported refined carbohydrate products would destroy people's teeth. And he found not only that, but even more interestingly, it destroyed that the teeth was like the canary in the coal mine. It destroyed their health generally. And he would see in this, for example, in the same family from the older children to the younger children, older children who'd grown up on the traditional diet, perfect mouths. They never brushed their teeth. So their mouths were not clean by our standards, but they had perfect teeth, no cavities, and they were healthy. And the younger children in the same family had tooth decay, rotted teeth, their entire facial structures collapsed so that they had sort of narrow faces. They did narrow jaws. They didn't have enough room for their teeth to grow in, which is something that's quite common today. And he saw the rest of their health decline. They had club feet. They had all other kinds. They were wasting. They were not robust or healthy. And I think what is so powerful about Weston A. Price's book is that he has pictures. There's something about those pictures, seeing these, like, you know, these Indian women with these incredible, beautiful teeth. We're seeing a photo of this family with the older children being healthy and the younger children with their health wrecked. And, you know, we live now in a society where there's so much illness. We are used to sickness and we're used to our children looking sick or emaciated. And so we don't even know what health looks like anymore. So that is what is very, very moving about his work in that book particularly.
Yeah, that's a very strong point that you just made, because we are products of our environment. Like your book has pointed out, people are eating a certain way. They're eating margarine. I remember when margarine came out, because I was born in the 50s, and I was so thankful to be part of the natural health food movement, which immediately condemned margarine as being a terrible product. You know, it would never go bad. It was hydrogenated and modified. And all of these ideas that you present in your book are actually in tune with what I've learned, you know, like natural whole food, plants and animals, because we do have a hunting-gathering past, which is really obvious when you study it. Makes a lot of sense. So at the end of the day, when you're finished your research, and I know what the message is, but what is your message to people out there when it comes to their concern about eating foods with cholesterol or saturated fat or even just fat in general?
I would say do not fear fat. First of all, the low-fat diet that we were set sail on really starting in about 1970. So if you remember, Ancel Keys had proposed avoiding saturated fats, but then that expanded to become all fats by 1970. Again, the American Heart Association launched us on that low-fat diet that means restrict fats overall. When that diet was finally tested in randomized controlled clinical trials in the 1990s, so that's just to let you know, we were on that diet for 20 years before it had ever been tested to be shown to be beneficial. NIH-funded trials on more than 50,000 people putting them on that diet for an average of 7 years, found absolutely no benefit from restricting fat. So the fat you eat, can you eat fat, and that does not go on your hips. Those trials showed that restricting fat could not be shown to help you lose weight, fight type 2 diabetes, prevent heart disease, or prevent any kind of cancer. Restricting fat does not work. Additionally, there's a large body of clinical trial research now, more than 70 clinical trials on some 7,000 people that now show that actually having a higher fat diet, so I'm talking anywhere from 40 to 70% of your calories is fat, and restricting carbohydrates, grains, those fattening grains again, that those diets are safe and effective and healthy. And those clinical trials include some that have lasted six that have lasted 2 years long, which show that there's no damaging side effects to that diet. It helps people lose weight, fight type 2 diabetes, very effective at that. There's just a trial out this week, and improve most cardiovascular risk factors. So do not avoid fat. Populations that eat more fat are healthier. As for cholesterol, dietary cholesterol, turns out that aspect of Ansel Keys' advice had been disproven by the 70s. It took a very long time for that to finally percolate up to the level where institutions that had invested in that, the American Heart Association and the U.S. government, were finally able to back out of that advice. So you may not know, but there are no more dietary cholesterol caps. So they've been dropped from any official recommendation. There's no reason you should have eaten egg white omelets. You should not avoid shellfish, which also has a lot of nutrients in it, as does the yolk of the egg. That's where all the nutrients in the egg are. Do not avoid liver if you happen to like it, a very nutrient-dense food. So there are no more caps on dietary cholesterol. As for saturated fat, that's the kind of one outstanding remaining recommendation that everybody seems to be sticking to. But according now to more than 14 systematic reviews and meta-analyses, scientific teams all over the world have gone back and looked at the evidence on saturated fats, in part because of my work and work of others. They have all universally concluded that saturated fats are not associated with heart disease. That's the epidemiological evidence, which is weaker. And the harder evidence shows that, so this is again, randomized controlled clinical trial evidence, reviews by scientists around the world concluding saturated fats have zero effect on cardiovascular or total mortality. So no reason to avoid saturated fats. And I have to add, they're also good for you. So saturated fats are the only food known to be able to raise your HDL, that's your good cholesterol. When you go to your doctor and your HDL is low and he says, oh, you need to exercise more, or maybe drinking a little more red wine might help on the margins. The food that most effectively, rapidly increases your HDL is saturated fats. So my advice would be go eat some more saturated fats.
Absolutely. Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, that's a pretty standard, typical response from the NIH and the AHA is drop, run, and hide. You know, when the truth comes out, it seems like all the people that were against it, instead of responding and saying, I'm sorry, we made a mistake, they say nothing. But we'll see what happens in the future. This is great stuff. You're on the cutting edge. You're part of the great movement forward. Truth is incontrovertible. It just takes a bit of time for all the idiots and a-holes out there to die off so that we can reach a place where the eagles nest up high in the sky. What about your websites, Nina? Can you tell us what those addresses are so our people can get to your book and start reading it right away?
That's really nice of you to ask. Okay, so my personal website is ninateichels.com, ninateichols.com. I also started a not-for-profit group called the Nutrition Coalition, and that group is dedicated to ensuring that our dietary guidelines, which are turn out to be tremendously powerful, based in Washington, D.C., we are trying to ensure that those dietary guidelines be based on the best and most current rigorous science so that everybody can get good health advice. And that website, if you're interested in that group, which is really trying to move the needle for all Americans, it's nutritioncoalition.us. Those are the places where, you know, my work, where I'm doing my work and publishing things. And on Twitter and Facebook, I'm at Big Fat Surprise. Know that.
Excellent. Wonderful. For everyone listening out there, get to the website, CoreyHolliday.com, and then look for SNU and click that and search for Nina's webpage, and you'll be able to get right to her websites for all of the latest information. Nina, our time is gone. Thanks a lot for a wonderful interview. Just love talking to you, and I love your book, and I'm going to do my darndest to promote it to everyone I know and get them reading that stuff.
Well, that's really nice of you. It's just been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for having me to share this with you.
One more final parting comment. I guess the question that comes to mind is, it's 2018. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. There's a lot of confusion. People really don't know what to do and how to do it. They're looking for truth somewhere, but they can't find it. What is your advice to, say, middle-aged men and women that want to pursue health but really don't know where to start?
Well, my advice, and I say this as a squarely middle-aged woman, but 20 pounds less than I was as a young woman who watched carefully everything she ate and was a vegetarian and exercised like a fanatic. But I was heavy always as a young adult. It's only since I realized that going on a low carbohydrate diet was really the right diet for me. And I think scientifically, we really have evidence to show that that diet works best for most people in head-to-head clinical trials looking at the low carb versus fat. So if I were looking to lose weight, fight diabetes, heart disease, fatty liver disease, or just to feel better, I know people who've gotten over their migraines, seen their acne disappear, all kinds of things you would never expect, I would look for information on the low-carb diet. I would go to the places I usually recommend are dietdoctor.com, a Swedish doctor who has excellent graphics, videos, introductions to low-carb. There's also a book called The Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Living by Jeff Volek and Steve Finney, a little bit more science in there. There are many resources. You can also look up the word ketogenic and find out that's a very low-carbohydrate diet. There's a lot out there. The hashtag is LCHF, low carb, high fat. So if you're interested to learn more, that's where I would go.
Nina Teichel is an investigative journalist and author of the international and New York Times bestseller, The Big Fat Surprise. Thanks very much, Nina. Keep doing what you're doing, and we look forward to more of your great work.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just a pleasure talking to you.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU. Sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.